Well, London is an expensive place to live, and with the rising inflation and rising bills, I guess many people are worried at the moment, aren't they, about the cost of living, especially those on benefits. So from next week, I think it is, in the UK, those who get universal credit will see their benefits cut by £20 a week, which, you know, might not seem much to most of us, but is life-changing for many people. So many people are rightly worried about the cost of living. Few people are worried about the cost of sinning. What is the cost of living as we want in God's world? What is the cost of going our own way, not God's way? The cost of ignoring him in his world, breaking his commands? Some think there's no cost at all. They think, you know, live as you want, don't worry about it. It won't be a problem. Others think that if there is a final judgment where we will be called to account and there is a cost to how we've lived, it will be very small. It'll be the equivalent of a slap on the wrist or a telling off or a parking fine. But the passage we just read says otherwise. It tells us that in the sufferings of Jesus, we see the real cost of sinning, and it is horrific. On the cross, Jesus was paying for sin. He wasn't paying for his own sin because he was sinless, but for the sins of his people. As you may remember in chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus said that he was giving his life as a ransom for many. So if we want to know the cost of sinning, we need only look at the cross. Here we see the true cost. And it is horrifically high. It is deadly serious. If we are those who trust in Jesus this morning, we believe, don't we, that he has paid for our sins. But do we realize quite what that means? Do we realize how high the price really was and what it is he has saved us from? Because this passage reveals that, and it should make us very thankful. And for those who don't trust in Jesus at the moment, if you think there is no cost to sinning, why would God allow his son, Jesus Christ, to suffer in this kind of way? Or if your attitude at the moment is, well, you know, I'm happy to pay for my sins myself, realize what you're saying. That in the sufferings of Jesus, we see what that involves. In chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus said ominously that the Son of Man must suffer many things. And in this chapter, we see what he meant. His sufferings were multidimensional. Don't remember a great deal from chemistry at school, but one experiment I do remember was chromatography. It was one of the funner ones. So chromatography is when you, this method for separating out and analyzing complex mixtures. So you may remember this one where you, in paper chromatography, you basically put some black ink on a filter paper and you suspend it in water. And then as the water is absorbed up the strip, the ink separates out into the different colors, the different color bands that it is made up of. Well, when you do chromatography, if you like, on the sufferings of Jesus, they separate out into these three main bands that you'll see inside your service sheet on the outline. That is the physical, the social, and the spiritual suffering. Firstly, there was the physical suffering. In verse 15, if you've still got the passage open on page 1028, so Mark 15, verse 15, we read that Jesus was scourged or flogged. This was a terrifying Roman punishment in which the victim was beaten by a number of guards until basically their flesh was hanging in bleeding shreds. And the instrument they used was a whip. It was a whip made of leather thongs. And to these thongs were attached pieces of bone or lead. And often men died during the flogging because it was so severe. In verses 16 to 20, Jesus was then tortured by the soldiers before being led out to be crucified. And normally the victim would carry his own crosspiece, that's to say the horizontal bit is what they would carry, to the place of crucifixion. But you'll see in verse 21, they forced somebody else to carry it for Jesus because presumably he was so weakened that he was unable to do it himself. And then in verse 24, it says simply, they crucified him. The Roman writer Cicero, he called crucifixion the most cruel and horrifying punishment. The historian Josephus describes it as the most wretched of all ways of dying. The English word excruciating comes from crucifixion with good reason. Jesus would have been stretched out, nailed to the horizontal beam. This was then lifted up and it was fastened to the upright beam, the upright post, and his feet would have been nailed as well. And death usually came from exhaustion. Verse 23 says they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he didn't take it. This was basically a narcotic. It was an anesthetic offered to the condemned to make them drowsy, to dull the pain. But notice Jesus refused any painkillers. He chose to endure this physical agony, fully conscious. Now, in his account here, Mark doesn't go into graphic details, does he, about the physical suffering? But the point is he didn't have to, because his first readers were familiar with these things in a way that we're not. But what he describes is horrific, and it fulfills how the Old Testament said the Christ would suffer. And we had this in our first reading, didn't we? Some years ago, when the film The Passion of the Christ came out, don't know if you saw it, but I remember going to see it with, I was living elsewhere up in the north of England, I went to see it with a friend who wasn't a Christian, and he was a big, tough guy, tattooed guy, who sort of led the local supporters club of the football club, and he was a tough local lad. He was self-confident, he was the sort of guy who always had something to say. As we walked out of the cinema after this film, he was completely quiet. He just didn't say a thing. And I finally asked him what he thought. And he said, that was the most powerful film I've ever seen. Because for him, you see, the cross had just been a piece of jewelry. And for the first time, he'd appreciated something of what Jesus suffered. Now, the question is, why in God's salvation plan did Jesus have to suffer so much physically? Why? The answer is because physical suffering is part of the cost of sinning. Physical suffering is part of the cost of sinning. So the penalty for sin, it does have a physical dimension. And so when Jesus suffered for us in our place, the price he paid, it had to include that physical suffering. We get a glimpse, don't we, of this physical cost of sin in our world today. So we live in a world in which there is so much physical suffering. Violence, abuse, hunger, disease, death. So why? Well, because of sin and because of God's judgment on that. But this physical cost of sin will be seen most starkly in the world to come. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus warned about a place where he said, their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. In Luke 16, verse 24, Jesus tells a story about a man who is in hell, a man who says, I'm in anguish in this flame. Now, whether or not these descriptions are literal or metaphorical, the fact is that hell is a physical reality. Everyone one day will be raised physically from death, either for life with God or for condemnation, and hell is a place of physical suffering. There'll be hell to pay. It's an expression people use, don't they? There'll be hell to pay. You know, if you don't get your homework in on time, there'll be hell to pay when you get to school. We use that expression, don't we? But in the sufferings of Jesus, we get an idea of what "there'll be hell to pay" really means. That as we witness his sufferings, we're a bit like tourists going on a day trip to hell. But wonderfully, Jesus suffered this for us so that we don't have to. The book of Revelation speaks of another place where it says, "Death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore." So those who trust in Jesus will enjoy life in resurrection bodies in that perfect world where there will be no physical suffering anymore, because that price of sin has been paid in full by Jesus. The second dimension of Jesus' sufferings here was social. We can call it that, sort of relational. So the Roman governor had the elite soldiers, had these elite soldiers called the Praetorium. It's like special forces. Verses 16 to 19, straight after Jesus has been flogged, the whole battalion, which would have been 600 men, they're gathered together to mock Jesus. So not just beat him up and torture him, but to mock him as well. And so you'll see they dress him in purple robe, like royalty. They jam this crown of thorns onto his head, and they kneel down in homage before him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." It's cruel, isn't it? Such cruel mocking. Then in verse 20, they led him out to crucify him. Death by crucifixion wasn't just physical agony, but it involved being stripped naked. In verse 24, you see the soldiers gamble for Jesus' clothing. So he was stretched out. He was publicly exposed. The site of the crucifixion in verse 22 we read was Golgotha, which was a small skull-shaped hill just outside the city walls of Jerusalem. It was the most shameful and humiliating way to die. The Roman writer Cicero said that even the mere word "cross" must remain far not only from the lips of citizens of Rome, but also from their thoughts, their eyes, and their ears. You see, such was the shame associated with crucifixion. And then there was yet more mocking. So verses 29 to 32 describe three groups of people who ridiculed Jesus as he hung there. First group, verse 29, those who passed by derided him. "Save yourself, come down from the cross." So the cross was next to a road, and so there were plenty of people going past. Second group, verse 31, so also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another. "He saved others. He can't save himself. Come down." Such cruelty. Third group, verse 32, those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And in verse 26, above his head, the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." It was meant as a cruel joke. "Look at this king. What a laugh." And he was utterly alone. So everyone was against him. He had been betrayed by his friend, deserted by his disciples, hated by the religious leaders, mocked even by those crucified with him. And the question again is why? So why in God's salvation plan did Jesus have to suffer such dishonor and shame and mocking and hatred and isolation? And the answer is, again, because that is part of the cost of sin. So the penalty for sin has a social dimension, a relational dimension. And so when Jesus suffered in our place, the price he paid, it had to include that. Again, we get a glimpse, don't we, of this social cost of sinning in our world today. One of the consequences of our rejection of God is that our world is filled with so much relational pain, social pain. So many broken relationships with all the misery that brings. hatred, envy, shame, loneliness, social breakdown, abuse. Sin has a very high price tag, doesn't it, in relationships, socially. But this social cost of sin will be seen, again, most starkly in the world to come, in hell. Sometimes people joke, don't they? They say, I don't mind going to hell because all my mates will be there. It'll be a party, it'll be fun. But hell is a place of total social breakdown. People will be shamed and humiliated, as Jesus was. People will be lonely, totally isolated, as Jesus was. There'll be no love, there'll be no friendship, just hatred and ridicule and cruelty, as Jesus experienced. There's a play by the French guy Jean-Paul Sartre called No Exit, in which three people who have died, they find themselves together in a locked room forever. And they get on each other's nerves, and they long to escape the gaze of the other person. And the famous line in this play, oft quoted, is that hell is other people. And so in eternity, hell will be other people. If you've read C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, he pictures hell as a place where nobody gets on. So people quarrel with their neighbors. And so what do they do when they quarrel with their neighbors? They move away. They move further away. And he speculates this keeps on happening. So that over the centuries, people move further and further and further away from one another until they end up being light years apart. He has this one bit where he says, through a telescope, you could just pick out Napoleon's house as a pinprick of light and nothing else near it for millions and millions of miles. Total isolation. Well, it's speculative, but it gets the point across that hell is a place of total social breakdown. But wonderfully, Jesus suffered this in our place. So we don't have to. For those who trust in him, this social price of sin has been paid in full. And so we can look forward to the eternal future described in Revelation as a new community. A place, a city where God's people will dwell. A place of love, a place of harmony, a place of peace. And instead of the shame and the dishonor that we deserve, those who trust in him will enjoy glory and honor because he suffered all that for them. And we get a foretaste of that now, don't we, as God brings his people together in church communities across the world as his family, as his flock. Lastly, and most significantly, Jesus' suffering was spiritual. Verse 34, we read, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Quoting Psalm 22, which was our first reading. On the cross, Jesus didn't just feel forsaken by God, he really was forsaken by the Father. And this would have been the ultimate agony for Jesus. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 11, at his baptism, voice from heaven had declared, you are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased. But now on the cross, the beloved Son became the object of God's righteous anger. Do you remember in the penultimate Exodus plague, darkness had covered the land of Egypt, and so now in verse 33, the darkness of God's judgment, it covered the land of Israel for 3 hours from midday as Jesus hung there, forsaken by God. And again, we ask why. Why in God's salvation plan did Jesus have to suffer this spiritual suffering, this alienation from God the Father? And the answer is that this is part of the cost of sin. That the penalty for sin has a spiritual dimension. And so when Jesus suffered in our place, the price he paid, it had to include that. And again, we get a glimpse of this, don't we? This spiritual price tag of sin in our world today. People who are alienated from God, empty, without hope, without purpose, without meaning. But this spiritual cost of sin will be seen most starkly in hell. Living in God's world now, people enjoy so many blessings, don't they, even if they ignore him. But in hell, the spiritual cost of sin will be experienced undiluted. Be a place of total alienation from the goodness of God. Jesus described it as a place of outer darkness, where the light of God's favor is never seen, but only the darkness of his righteous anger. A place of utter despair, of futility, without hope. But again, wonderfully, because Jesus suffered this for us, we don't have to. For those who trust in him, this spiritual cost of sin has been paid in full. And the way into God's presence has been opened wide. Verse 38, we read that the moment Jesus died, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. For centuries, this huge, heavy curtain in the temple had been a no-entry sign separating the people from God's presence in the Holy of Holies. And only the high priest had been able to enter, and only once a year. But now God had torn the curtain down. So no longer any need for priests and sacrifices and temples. All who trust in Jesus can enter the presence of God. They're reconciled with him. They're adopted as his children. They know him as Father. We can now look forward to this eternal future in a place where the Bible says God will dwell with them and they'll be his people and God himself will be with them as their God and they will see his face. So here in chapter 15, we get this breakdown of the cost of living, the cost of living as we want in God's world. And we see that the cost physically, socially, spiritually, in the sufferings of Jesus. So as he picks up the bill for the sin of his people, and he pays it in full. What should we take from this? I'll put on the sheet there four things. Firstly, that God's justice is scary. The sufferings of Jesus show us how seriously God takes sin. We may think sin is not a big deal, but the cross tells us that a holy God sees things very differently. When God says he will judge sin, he's not joking. The Bible is very clear about the coming judgment and the reality of hell, and we are fools if we ignore the warnings. God is not some senile grandfather in heaven. His plan for the universe is not that it might be truly said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all, as C.S. Lewis put it. The God who is there is holy, he's just, and messing with him is not a good idea. Second, the suffering of Jesus tells us that God is staggeringly loving. That God in Jesus came down to endure such suffering for us in our place is staggering. That he went through all that for you and me. The sufferings of Jesus tell us that we are more loved than we could have ever imagined. Third, it leaves us with a simple choice. You know what it's like when you get your credit card bill? Somebody has got to pay. Yeah, when you get your credit card bill, somebody has got to pay. You can't just hide it in a drawer. You can't just rip it up. You can't just put it in the bin or through the shredder. Doing that, it doesn't make it disappear. It doesn't make it go away. Somebody's got to pay. Well, living as we want in God's world has a huge price tag. And the question is, who's going to pay? Either we allow Jesus to pay for us, or we ourselves will have to pay in eternity. And the sufferings of Jesus have given us some idea of what that is like. In a moral universe, somebody has got to pick up the bill for your sin. And it can't be the person sitting next to you on the barge today, because they've got their own bill to deal with. And so God is saying, give it to me, let me pay. Jesus suffered for you to pay the price in full. Will you accept that? Now, for those of us who have accepted that, we could easily devote a whole separate talk to exploring the implications of that. So seeing what Jesus suffered for us, it should fill us with deeper love for him. And it should fill us with a greater hatred of sin in our lives and a firmer assurance that there is now no condemnation for us. It should fill us with increased boldness in telling other people. It should fill us with real comfort when we ourselves are suffering physical pain or social rejection for Christ, or at times when we feel that God is far away, knowing that Jesus has been there before us. But if that's not you, as we close, which of the various responses in the passage would you identify with most at the moment? In verse 21, there's this guy, Simon of Cyrene. He's a passing Libyan. He's forced to carry the cross for Jesus. Like him, maybe your involvement with Jesus so far has been involuntary. Perhaps you were made to go to chapel at school, or maybe you were forced to go to church when you were younger, and you resent it, and it's put you off. Then in verse 23, there are the soldiers. And for them, it's just a routine execution. It's just another day in the office for those guys. They don't see anything significant in the sufferings of this man. They're more interested in dividing up the profits, the clothes. Like them, maybe you're someone who's just focused on doing your job, earning a living. In verse 31, there are the religious leaders. They mock Jesus. They mock his claim to be the Christ. Like them, maybe you're a religious person who has dismissed Jesus, dismissed his claims. Then in verse 35, there are the bystanders who think that Jesus is calling Elijah when in fact he's calling out to God. The words, they sound similar in Hebrew and Aramaic. Like them, maybe you've never really understood until now why Jesus died. And these bystanders in verse 36, they even try to keep Jesus alive by giving him sour wine to drink, waiting for Elijah to come and rescue him. You know, for them, it was good entertainment. And so for some people, they just go along to church at Christmas, at Easter, for the show. But the end of the passage, verse 39, we read of a different response. It says, and when the centurion who stood facing him, when he saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. And maybe like him, maybe you see now who Jesus is. Well, your sin, just like mine, it has a huge price tag. Why not let Jesus, the Son of God, pick up the bill for you?